Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with John Rawling, Ian Dark and myself, Tris Dixon. Huge thanks to those of you who have taken the time to rate and review this podcast on iTunes and wherever you choose to listen to it. We are aware that you are competing, or we are competing, against a lot of podcasts, be it boxing or otherwise, and we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. This week we are talking about the career of the wonderful Evander Holyfield, a two-weight world champion, former Olympian, who is a bona fide Hall of Famer, if ever there was one. And Ian, I think you crossed paths with him or would have laid eyes on him long before John or I did, right?
Yeah, the first time I saw Evander Holyfield was at the 1984 Olympics, when I probably watched just about every bout. That was the Olympic Games where Jack Nicholson also did the same thing at ringside. And I had the privilege even of interviewing him at some point during all of that. But yeah, Holyfield got to the semi-final. And I think, as is very well known now, he was disqualified in his fight with the New Zealander. Kevin Barry was nowhere near in his class. Holyfield was undoubtedly going to go on and win that semi-final and win the gold medal as well. But he didn't. He was frustrated there, but, you know, I think he kind of made up for it later on, didn't he?
Yeah, it was an incredible class, the 1984 team of USA. It was really an iconic bunch of fighters, wasn't it? Pernell Whittier, yeah. Meldrick, and so forth.
Virgil Hill, Mark Breland, yeah, a few more.
And, John, how about you? When was the first time Evander came into your consciousness? I guess it was probably those Olympics where you were watching on.
Well, yeah, just watching it as a fan, you know, watching the Olympics, and he was clearly somebody with talent. But from a professional point of view, when he moved on from there, the first time I really became aware of him was when he had his war against Dwight Muhammad Quoy as cruiserweight. And he, of course, as a cruiserweight, he became arguably one of the outstanding cruiserweights of all time. He beat everybody out there. And then when he moved up, of course, they were looking for somebody. This coincides with the time of Mike Tyson. So they were looking for somebody credible as a potential opponent for Mike Tyson. And I guess that's when it really started to take root. That's when people started to really talk about Evander Holyfield, when he could be potentially an opponent for Tyson.
Yeah, I mean, the fact was, really, in those early days, he wasn't a big star, was he? He wasn't a marquee, really. He people knew he was good and that he dominated the cruiserweight division, but people were kind of only semi-interested in the cruiserweight division, and they knew he was around, but they didn't think he'd be able to move up and make any kind of waves as a heavyweight. It was only when he became a heavyweight that he became a star.
Yeah, I think that's worth noting. So obviously the cruiserweight division only started, I think, in either 1980 or 1981 in a fight between Marvin Kamel and Mate Pavlov. And so it was still, by the time Evander fought Dwight Carwey for the first time at the Omni in Atlanta in arguably the last great 15-round fight, it was only 5 or 6 years old. So it was embryonic. There was no real pedigree to it. There'd certainly been no Hall of Fame champions really up to that point. Yeah. At cruiserweight, obviously, Michael Spinks had vetoed it altogether to jump from, or would do, from light heavyweight up to heavyweight to fight Larry Holmes and a bunch of others.
And those 84 Olympics, he was fighting as a light heavyweight. That's what he was. I mean, his story is absolutely incredible, really, that he made that jump and made so much money and such a success of it and became such a talked about fighter.
Yeah, and before we get to the heavyweight Holyfield, I guess, I mean, I knew Dwight, or know Dwight Carwey, relatively well from over the years. And they had the rematch. Obviously, they had this great first fight and the second fight, which Carwey had about 18 months later. Carl, we found out that Holyfield was being paid far more than him and basically decided to sit the fight out after four rounds. He's like, I'm not getting paid enough for this. And that was that. So people were anticipating this huge rematch, and Cowie just basically had enough and said, no, you know, I'm not gonna, you haven't paid me enough to fight properly. So he jacked it in. So Evander had an easier night than advertised there. But, you know, we've talked about some of these names in previous episodes, but when he stepped up after he beat Carlos De Leon and unified the title, he fought James Tillis, Pinklin Thomas, Michael Doakes. Those are the sort of names you need, aren't they, in that jump up, right, John?
Yeah, he was matched well, wasn't he? He did a contract with the Duvers, who were very shrewd operators, and he came through them and came through those fights well. He stopped Tillis and Thomas, who were decent heavyweights. They were name heavyweights. Doakes also was a 10th round TKO. And then before you know where you are, you're starting to really motor. He came through Adelson Rodriguez, Alex Stewart, who was a decent heavyweight in his day. And before you know where you are, he's up there in very real contention. And had Tyson not been beaten by Buster Douglas, then he would have had a shot at him then. As it was him against Buster Douglas himself and then George Foreman. And of course, that's when the massive money days really started for Evander Holyfield.
I mean, worth obviously mentioning here, Ian, that, you know, John says Buster Douglas there. Well, Evander was being thought of as the opponent for Tyson before Buster Douglas came in. And then I think the idea was that obviously that Tyson was going to fight Evander after Buster Douglas. But you actually had the best seat in the house in that respect, in the sense that you watched Tyson Douglas with Evander Holyfield.
Well, that was incredible. I think I might have told the story in one of the earlier episodes, but it's worth the repetition, that how I met him in the elevator, as the Americans call it, the lift at the hotel on the eve of the fight, and said, you know, can we do an interview with you at some point during the night? I said, where are you going to be sitting? He said, I don't know. I said, well, how do you fancy sitting with us? He said, yeah, that'd be great. Where are you? Ringside? I said, yeah, right at ringside. So he sat with us and we had him on the broadcast. I mean, didn't pay him a penny. He never asked us for any. So, so there we had this instant reaction as he watched his big fight with Mike Tyson disappear before his eyes as Buster Douglas won, you know, so sensationally in Tokyo. But I mean, his time was always going to come to get a shot. I mean, as John was saying earlier, they were looking for credible opponents for Tyson, and Holyfield was now sort of barging the door down, really, with his form as a heavyweight. I think he proved that he could make the step up and he could be a factor. So, you know, he was an interesting character, wasn't he, as well? I mean, I've found an old commentary card the things I wrote about him, I put style, intensity, pride, bravery, heart, stoical, stone-faced, dignified, ambassador, work rate, always in good fights. You know, so, you know, he was value for money, wasn't he? Almost every time.
Hey, let me ask you this, Ian. If you're sat next to Evander Holyfield for this fight, for Tyson Douglas, if you size him up, are you thinking this guy's big enough to make an impact at heavyweight? Or back then, as he was in his infancy as a heavyweight, are you thinking, God, this guy's not that big?
Well, yeah, because he weighed, what, around 210 pounds, isn't he? You know, 15 stone-ish, wasn't he? Around that, even though he beefed up, he was 6 feet, 2.5 inches tall. So he was tall enough. But come on, most people, when he fought Mike Tyson the first time, didn't really give him much of a prayer. They thought, he's just going to get blown away. He's good and he'll give it a go, but Tyson's going to beat him. what did they know? What did we all know?
John, sorry, I cut you off there.
I was just going to say this in the run-up to that fight against Buster Douglas. You know, I mean, he'd produced some pretty impressive performances. They were all by stoppage. And the thing I always thought about Evander is that he had this absolute certainty. You know, the one word triggers that Ian had written down there, like heart and passion and dignity, et cetera, et cetera. He'd got all of that, but the biggest thing he had was his bravery. He was afraid of no man, never was, and that's what served him well. And arguably, by the time he eventually fought Mike Tyson, when was the first one? 1996, November 96. I think most people thought by then his best days were a long way behind him, but he'd had some great days on the run up to then.
Yeah, well, fights. I mean, the 10th round of the Bow fight, the first one, was just incredible, amazing. I think it was voted the round of the year. It's one of the great rounds of heavyweight history, isn't it? You know, and Holyfield lost that fight, but I think that was the night that everybody said, wow, this guy is quite something. So sometimes in boxing, you know, you can win and your reputation can go down because you've stunk the place out. And other times you can lose and your reputation goes through the roof. And that's what happened to Holyfield in that first fight with Bo, I think.
Did either of you cover Holyfield v. Buster Douglas after Buster Douglas had lost his sixth rounder with the buffet in the build-up?
Yes, I was there. I was at that fight. And I mean, it was massive for Holyfield that night, but it was fairly self-evident when you saw Buster Douglas that he was in nothing like the shape that he'd been when he fought Mike Tyson. He'd clearly living the life, shall we say, and Holyfield did a number on him. You know, the fight was all over pretty quickly. What was it? Three rounds. Great atmosphere.
And the other thing, John, do you remember the great line? I can't remember the writer, and I should remember because he deserves to be credited. He came out with that great line about Buster Douglas that night. He said, float like a buffalo, sting like a gnat.
Well, it was about right, wasn't it? You know, and when you think about the level of performance he produced when he fought Tyson, it really was literally like a different man when he got in against... when he got in against Evander.
He cashed in the heavyweight title, didn't he, really? He cashed in the check. He put in the big performance with Tyson. He was one of those fighters before Tyson where, you know, he blew hot and cold, mostly cold. And I think he decided that was it. He'd reached his pinnacle and he was going to have a very, very big payday, which he did. I can't remember how many million dollars and, you know, live happily ever after, hopefully.
It was something approaching, it was 25, 30 million or something, wasn't it? I mean, it was, for the time, it was an extraordinary amount of money he got paid. Huge.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's worth thinking about. Because I remember speaking to Buster Douglas about this back in the day. And, you know, everyone knows that going into that Tyson fight, his mother had recently passed, Lula Pearl. He was at odds with his father. He was going through, you know, hard times with his marriage. And I remember speaking to him about this. He said, just because I beat Mike Tyson, it didn't fix any of that stuff. And when I got home to reality, all of that stuff was still there. And that's when he piled on the pounds. So I think people thought that he was dining out and living the life. And maybe he was, but he was in a pit of depression and despair. And obviously you just think, oh, he beats Tyson. He then goes and blows the lot and, you know, puts on stupid amount of weights. But he had a lot of demons that he was still trying to confront when he got back home to Columbus, Ohio. And then obviously Evander took full advantage. And you remember there was all the legal stuff, wasn't there, at the time, in terms of Don King and Steve Wynn. And like you said, John, but about 25 to 30 million resolved in the end. And Evander was the new heavyweight champion of the world. And little did we know, really, I think even then, I think more people were saying about how Buster Douglas had blown it than how Evander had won it. Right, John?
Yeah, I think that's so. I'm not sure that Evander at that point got the credit that was due to him, you know, because he absolutely did a number on him, didn't he? And I think it was only in the fights following that that people began to wake up. You know, his own massive payday came the following year in 1991 in Atlantic City when he was matched against the comebacking George Foreman. And then there was Burt Cooper, Larry Holmes. And then from there on, you're into the massive Bow fights. And he really had by that stage. Because remember, Tyson had been incarcerated because of the rape business. Holyfield had become the biggest ticket seller in boxing.
Yeah, he had that big scare with Bert Cooper. I covered that fight in Atlanta, in his home city, and it looked for a minute as like we were going to have a sensation, but that was it with Holyfield. He never really was intimidated out of a fight and would always seem to find a way back. You know, he lost a few, didn't he? I think he lost 10 overall in the end, but you're right. He always came back with plenty. If he got hit, he'd get over it, fight his way back into the fight. And that's what happened with Bert Cooper that night. But it was a scare, that one.
Yeah, Ian, it's funny you mentioned that Bert Cooper one, because that was sandwiched by wins over George Foreman and Larry Holmes. But it was the Bert Cooper fight that everyone really remembers because Evander was really hurt and shaken up. And Bert Cooper, I think, was a late replacement. He came in from nowhere.
Yeah,
sorry, John.
I was going to say that, his absolute fearlessness. I know we're going to go on to it in more detail a bit later on for the fights against Mike Tyson, but his fearlessness was his trademark, wasn't it? He absolutely refused to be intimidated. And I'm sure that people will be asking us questions about, well, what would have happened had he fought Mike Tyson in 1990 or 1991 instead of 1996? You know, for what it's worth, I think that there's a very real argument that Holyfield might always have had Mike Tyson's number because Tyson traded on intimidation and Holyfield absolutely would not be intimidated.
Yeah. I mean, his wife, you know, at the time was a doctor specializing in pain management. And he used to say, the ability to take pain with a poker face is what I'm about. The prize has to be greater than the pain.
Wow. There you go. Can't say it more succinctly than that. Well, so he beats Foreman, Cooper, Larry Holmes, and then comes this first bow fight at the Thomas and Mack Center. Like Ian says, it's a fight for the ages. Going into it as well, so he'd got past Larry Holmes, but was far from impressive, and it was far from emphatic. And this is the same Larry Holmes that 4 years earlier had been bombed into destruction by Mike Tyson. So people were saying that, you know, maybe Holyfield's not a fully fledged heavyweight, and now he's fighting a 31-0 Riddick Bowe, hugely talented, former Olympian, and he's going in as the champion, but perhaps as the underdog against a much bigger man, right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it took Holyfield probably a decade, you know, to become an overnight sensation, didn't it? So, you know, that fight was absolutely magnificent. And as I've said, probably a little out of turn earlier because I jumped the queue a little bit getting to that Bow fight. He was brilliant in defeat that night. It was one of those fights that might have gone either way. You know, it went on to become a trilogy, didn't it? And such a storied trilogy as well. But I think we were all thrilled when we left the Thomas and Mack Center that night. We're still talking about it.
That 10th round goes down as one of the very great rounds in heavyweight history. You know, that stands comparison with any round you ever see anywhere. And if people want to know about Evander Holyfield and don't know, then watch that 10th round because it was just startling. The first early part of the round, Bo looks as though he's going to take him out. But he arguably almost punched himself out, didn't he, Ian? And then Holyfield manages to come back and has Bo rocking in the closing stages of the round. It was just absolutely spine-tingling. You know, I mean, all these years later, more than 30 years later, I still remember that round and the hairs kind of stand up on the back of your neck because it's the sort of round and the sort of fight which hooks you into boxing in the first place. And when you're actually close up to seeing that, you realise the bravery and the intensity that these men can produce. And that 10th round was absolutely epic.
Yeah, that's right up there with the first round of Thomas Hearns against Marvin Hagler in 1985 and a couple of the rounds in that first Morales-Barrera all-Mexican grudge fight. In that category, you know, any youngsters listening, because we're a few old fogies, aren't we? We're not Tris, but you and I, John, going on about these old fights. But, you know, go out to YouTube and dig out round 10 of Bo Holyfield.
So he then he loses to Bo on points, and then rebounds with another win over Michael. Alex. No joke. Sorry, Alex Stewart. I'm thinking about Michael. No joke, Stewart. But Alex Stewart, and then he rebounds into Riddick Bowe. So Holyfield fights Bowe a second time. And were either of you there the night of the fan, man?
I was indeed. What an extraordinary night it was. I mean, Evander had improved that night. He was going really well anyway for the first half of the fight. And then comes the fan man who comes down from goodness knows where and flies his little microlight kite into the ring canopy, and everybody wonders what the hell is going on. I can remember I was sitting watching this fight alongside this old guy who he may well have been from Philly or something like that, and he'd kept his own counsel. He looked about 85 years old, and he hadn't said a word the way through. And then suddenly he looks up at the sky and sees this thing coming down towards the canopy. And I remember him shouting, "What the fuck?" You know, this thing comes crashing into the canopy. The fight, of course, is stopped. Dan Duva is not well as a result of it. Eddie Futch also has a bad turn. You know, two veteran trainers there with this going on. And there was the gap in the action. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And eventually, after what seemed like an eternity, they decided that the fight could go on. And Holyfield carried on where he left off. He outboxed Bo that night and emerged worthily as the WBO and IBF heavyweight champion of the world.
It was so dangerous, wasn't it, what happened there? I think the fan man ended up getting beaten up by some people at ringside a bit, didn't he? He got roughed up, and I think Bo's wife fainted and ended up in hospital that night.
Yeah, and I think he ended up taking his own life in 2002 as well, the fan man. James Miller was his name. But John, let me ask you this. I mean, when you saw it happen, what did you think? Did you think it was a stunt? Did you think it was part of the show? Did you think it was just did you think it was some lunatic, or what did you think? Did you think it was a big mistake?
I just remember thinking, well, I mean, I didn't react quite in the manner of the guy who was sitting next to me. I didn't start shouting and swearing, but I remember looking up and thinking, God, what is this? Because it was absolutely, well, to my experience, completely without precedent. You know, we were on the open air, the old open air Caesars Palace tennis courts at the back of the hotel, great open air arena. There was no way you could really compute what was going on. And the only time when it actually became a reality was that when the guy crashed into the ring. And then you sort of think, well, you do realize then what has happened. And but even then you didn't realize whether it was somebody making a protest, whether it was somebody who was going to have a bomb, or whether it was just somebody who thought it was great fun to do this. It was actually, for a few minutes, I remember being quite frightened by it.
I wasn't there. I was watching it on the TV. I mean, it's what we always used to say and joke about when we were on the Atlantic City Boardwalk or on the Strip in Las Vegas, John. Just when you've seen everything or think you've seen everything in the boxing jungle, something else comes along. It's part of the fascination, the weird fascination.
Yeah,
that
it was just absolutely bizarre, wasn't it? It was one of the most irrational and unthought about moments in the history of heavyweight boxing, and there it was. From the Holyfield point of view, the Holyfield narrative, though, it was the night he became a champion again.
Yeah.
And John, I don't know if you remember this, but a young David Tuer was on the undercard, and an old Thomas Hearns was. So interesting stuff.
Well, I don't remember Tua. Who did he fight? Do you know that off the top of your head?
No, he was only about 9 or 10-0 at the time. So they would have just been serving people up.
Right. Well, Chris's knowledge is brilliant, isn't it? Fancy remembering that.
He was coming through, of course. And I suppose the interesting tie-in was that Tua's career at that stage, I think, was being helped by Kevin Barry, who was the man who had fought Holyfield all those years ago at the Olympics.
Well, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but Tua was also being used as a sparring partner for Holyfield ahead of the Tyson fight. which, as far as sparring goes, isn't bad. So after Evander beats Bo in the fight of the Fan Man, he loses his titles to Michael Mora, who becomes the first world heavyweight Southpaw champion of all time. I think that was probably most known for Teddy Atlas losing his mind with Michael Mora in the corner at the time. Any memories of Holyfield Mora?
Oh, yeah, big memories of that. I mean, Mora was some strange individual. He walked into one of the pre-fight press conferences once and said, "I don't want to say much here," and got out a packet of mints and said, "Any of you guys want a mint? Let's start with a mint." And it kind of went on in that rather weird vein. Anyway, I mean, he'd go vacant in the middle of fights, wouldn't he, Mora? He had talent. There was no question about that. But that fight is, you know, it's well known because I just shut up between all the rounds we were covering it because Teddy Atlas was giving this performance in the corner and it was right out of Shakespeare. And he was saying things to Mora to try and keep him concentrated, like, "There comes a time in a man's life, Michael, when he's got to decide. Do you want to be something in this business? Or do you not want to be something in this business? What are you going to tell your friends? What are you going to tell your family if you don't go out there now and do what you know you've got to do? Now go out there now and do it." He was better than that. I'm just kind of paraphrasing. But this was round after round of this wonderful psychological pep talk from Teddy Atlas. And I think he won Michael Mora the fight that night. Well, it all sank in, and that night, you know, it was a bit like Buster Douglas the night he produced it against Tyson. Mora just fought way above himself and beat Holyfield.
And Holyfield was bad that night as well, wasn't he? That was the day when they said he was physically not right, and people, even at that stage, when he was, 31 or thereabouts, people started thinking, are the great days behind him? Has he finished as a heavyweight? Is he ill? People were even saying that.
Well, yeah, because the heart thing came up, didn't it, around that time, that the heart irregularity and the retirement at that stage.
So he lost to Mora. He came back and beat very, very tough, teak tough, dare I say, Ray Mercer. On points, and then the loss in the trilogy fight via stoppage to Riddick Bowe. And I guess people then were starting to write him off. He'd lost two of his last three. There was sort of a question mark over his health. And, you know, it looked like his best days had come and gone, right, Ian?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there were all those kind of question marks, but he was one of those guys that just kept bouncing back and proving everybody wrong. He'd had to retire, and there was this business, wasn't it, where he went to this sort of TV preacher at the end of it all after he'd been away for a while and said, "My heart is healed." There was some kind of laying of hands. Holyfield was reputed to have paid about $265,000 to this guy called Benny Hinn, and suddenly he was all right again, and he passed all the medical exams and was allowed back into the ring to reestablish himself once more. No wonder they called this guy the real deal. He really was.
He looked dreadful that night against Bobby Chez, though, didn't he? It was in Madison Square Garden in 1996. It was an undercard fight of when Lennox Lewis fought Ray Mercer, if memory serves me right. And although Evander won, Bobby Chez was out of there, retired in five rounds, I think. He looked poor that night, Evander. And the thought of him going in against Mike Tyson after that was, frankly, just staggering, because people, is he going to get killed? Being as frightened as that for the well-being of Evander Holyfield on the back of what was a fairly awful performance against Bobby Chez, having lost to Riddick Bowe in the previous fight.
Yeah,
and even though people thought Tyson had had his own way, and he had done through this comeback of Peter McNeely, Bruce Seldon, Bruno, all the guys we've mentioned, Buster Mathis Jr., the idea was that Holyfield was almost of that ilk, and he was damaged goods. And John, you mentioned the heart issues and all the rest of it. And he was just going to be knocked over like another nine pin, right, Ian?
Yeah, I think people saw it as a dangerous mismatch. There was this guy who'd had the question mark about his heart condition, and it had been waved through in the end. You thought, this could be horrible. It really could. But I remember something that Holyfield said in the build-up to that fight. I mean, John touched on it earlier on, how he never was intimidated. He loved the business. And do you remember when he got into the ring with Tyson, he was singing. You remember how Tyson used to kind of intimidate and beat people before the start of their fights? Holyfield got in the ring singing songs to himself. He thought, Tyson looked across the ring at him, I think, and thought, what is this? This guy, I'm not getting to this guy at all. I remember something Holyfield said in the build-up. He said, Tyson scares people and wins without having to fight. None of that stuff's going to work with me. Well, that's how the story kind of unfolded. Wasn't it?
It very soon became clear in that fight that that was the case, wasn't it? So I remember I watched that fight. I didn't actually cover that fight. I'd been doing Nigel Benning and Steve Collins in Manchester, and we watched it in a restaurant in Manchester. And you know, as that started to unfold, the fight, it was clear from a fairly early stage, sort of fourth, fifth round onwards, that Holyfield was not buying into the Tyson steamrolling mystique. He was putting him onto the back foot. He was starting to land big shots. And before you know where you were, it was not only clear that he was not being intimidated, it was also became clear that he was starting to do a number big time on Mike Tyson.
His power was underrated, I think, at times, Holyfield. He hit hard and sharply that night, and he truly believed that Tyson was nowhere near the same fighter, just as John said, going backwards, and he made him go backwards. He took control of that fight. Yeah, I think the signs were there really pretty early on in the fight. That
Fourth round, baby.
Yeah, maybe as early as that, hang on a minute, maybe a sensation's brewing here.
Yeah, one of the words maybe missing off the list of adjectives, Ian, that you said about at the top was stubborn. He refused to give any ground, didn't he, psychologically or physically that night?
Yeah, absolutely. And he believed he was the superior technician. He'd been watching Tyson a long time. Remember how he'd been frustrated, you know, and had to wait for this chance to get in the ring with him. And he'd worked out that fight. He'd probably fought it 1,000 times in his head, and then he went in the ring and did it for real.
And then I think he toppled Tyson with a left hook. But at the end, I mean, Tyson was all over the show, wasn't he? And Evander was piling in behind heavy combinations. I think there was dozens of unanswered punches, wasn't there? And then that was it. He'd done the impossible, right?
He didn't merely beat him, did he? In the end, he absolutely beat him up. And I think on that night, the mystique of Mike Tyson was exploded and had gone forever. Tyson could never be the same man after that.
Well, I think if it hadn't after that, it was after the rematch, which was obviously the bite fight where Tyson was disqualified for twice biting Evander Holyfield's ears, claiming, by the way, that obviously it was in retaliation for Evander headbutting him through the first fight, through the second fight. I suppose that's something that we need to mention. Holyfield did have this thing with that big bald chrome dome of his for leading with the head. There was the reputation, wasn't there, Ian?
Yeah, absolutely. Tyson might have even had a point about that. But, you know, Teddy Atlas, the famous trainer, you know, he knew about Tyson, and he kind of predicted before the fight that Tyson would be looking for a way out. I think Tyson knew that Holyfield had his number. So he resorted to street tactics to try to do something about it, you know, biting Evander Holyfield's ear. I remember doing the commentary on that fight and watching it, and I checked myself before saying it because I thought, did that really happen? Have I seen that right? Has he bitten his ear there? Well, yeah, you could see the blood and everything once, you know, the two heads came apart again. Just astonishing, really, that Tyson would do that. He did himself so much damage, I think, in the eyes of boxing fans that night. What he did was cheapened the sport, really, didn't it?
So I remember doing a big Ian, right? Ian, sorry, hold on, John. Ian, did you see it with your own two eyes, or were you watching on the monitor?
No, I was watching. You know, we were there at ringside. I was watching the fight. It was happening probably 12 feet in front of me. You know, we're lucky enough to have a perfect pitch. So, yeah, I was right on the scene. But I have to admit, I kind of disbelieved what I'd saw. I didn't want to say he's bitten him before I was, you know, damn sure that that was exactly what happened in the fight, because it's a long way back as a commentator from making a call like that if it ain't right.
Yeah, and I suppose the same for Mills Lane as a referee. If you haven't, you know, do you actually go with it and think that has actually happened, or do you look in disbelief and say, no, that couldn't have been the case? Sorry, John, I did cut you off there.
No, it was just following up on what you said about Teddy Atlas. I remember I was over there reporting for BBC Radio, and what turned out to be probably the hardest night and the longest night's work of my entire career. But I was also writing for The Guardian, and I got hold of Teddy Atlas and said, you know, what do you make of it? And he, to underline what Ian said, he said it was a street thing. He said Mike Tyson couldn't stand getting undressed for a second time in public. He didn't want to have his trousers taken down and the world to see him for what he was. And he found the coward's way out. He said it was the street's way of surrender.
Great stuff. So then, memories.
Get the ear, didn't he? He's got it in that. You remember he had the bit of the ear, Holyfield. I mean, he just shrugged his shoulders about all of that. I think he'd seen everything. He put it in a pickled jar on his desk, didn't he, Holyfield?
Well, and subsequently, I mean, we talked about this with other fighters, but they became great friends as well. And I think they did a TV commercial about it years down the line as well. And all the rest of it. So interesting stuff.
It was an astonishing weekend altogether. Do you remember Tupac had been shot dead on the in front of Caesar's Palace in some, you know, big rap gang shooting confrontation? And as well as that, after the fight was over, there were supposedly gunshots sounded in the casino at the MGM. They tried to say that they were champagne corks going off, but I don't think anybody bought that. There was a riot as people panicked in the MGM, and hundreds, thousands of people were surging for the exits, and they had to close the casino, and it cost the MGM just untold amounts of money, because the after-fight gambling sessions, when the big hitters are in town, that's when they really make their money back. And they lost all that because they had to close the casino.
You're right, John. It was a really scary night. And I was among those crowds who made a sprint for the exit that night. But I also remember, do you remember Jim Gray, the American interviewer, interviewing Tyson after the fight and trying to get an exit? Explanation from him, and Don King, and I love this, Don King kept trying to interrupt the interview, and for the only time I ever heard any interview to say that, Jim Gray turned around to Don King and said, "Shut up, Don, I'm talking to Mike." Jim Gray was a star that night. His interview with Tyson afterwards was fantastic, really, you know, bearing in mind everything that had just gone on.
Yeah, you can still see that on YouTube, and it's well worth checking out. So Holyfield then is obviously riding the crest of a wave. He comes back and he beats Michael Moore in the rematch. He stops Michael Moore, and so obviously gains a measure of vengeance. And then he fights Vaughn Bean, who was 31-1 at the time. And then comes this first fight with Lennox Lewis in New York, which is one of the great robberies, most controversial fights that crossed over from the sport into the front pages of all the mainstream media, where people just cried robbery because Holyfield was gifted a draw when he'd apparently been soundly outboxed by Lennox Lewis. And we say all the great things about Holyfield, and rightly so, but he got an absolute gift by living with his titles that night, didn't he, John?
Oh, totally. I can remember watching it. I didn't actually commentate on that one. I think the fight was done by TalkSport in the early years of that network. So I was actually sitting watching as a reporter stroke spectator. But I can remember being just absolutely incensed that Lewis had been in my view, looking at it for, as an outsider, had been cheated out of his out of winning the title. And I can remember taking on Don King with microphone in hand, saying, "What on earth was all that about? That's a disgrace, etc., etc." You know, sort of impartiality flying right out of the window. And Don's response is, "Hey, we can dance again. We can dance again." In other words, we've had this controversy, but as a result of it, there'll be a rematch and we'll all get even richer. And he was absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, but Ian, it's unsavoury. I mean, sometimes when you get those kind of scorecards, you think not only do you want to be somewhere else, but you think, God, I should be covering a different sport. You can't justify it.
You can't justify it. The headline in the New York Post the next morning, front page, was "It stinks." I remember seeing that on the newsstand. If you go back on that fight, look at the fifth round of it. Now, if you were sort of teaching someone how to score boxing, you'd never done it before. You say, here's a very one-sided round. You give it, you score one guy 10 and the other guy 9. Okay, the winner of the round gets 10, the loser of the round gets 9, maybe even 8 if it was particularly one-sided. The fifth round, Lewis is absolutely battering Holyfield, really, from beginning to end of the round. Eugenia Williams scoring at ringside, our professional judge scores the round to Holyfield. Now, there's no place to hide from that. You know, that is at best huge incompetence. And, well, I don't want to say really beyond that. But I remember when they were reading out the scorecards at the end and they said split decision, we all looked at each other and said, "What? Split decision? You're kidding." Anyway, on it went. And I thought, well, no, it's going to be a majority. Lewis is going to win because it was one scorecard. Eugenia Williams is, of course, for Holyfield. The other one for Lennox. And the third scorecard was our London judge, Larry O'Connell, who scored the fight level. We spoke to Larry afterwards and said, "Did you really think it was level?" He said, "No, I'm pretty sure I'd scored it for Lennox." But he didn't know, of course, because they hand in the scores at the end of each round. He'd scored it level somehow. I mean, one of the craziest injustices ever in the history of boxing. Lennox Lewis won that fight easily.
As you said, he was a victim of politics.
Well, they had the rematch. That was obviously in New York. They had the rematch. They took it across the states to the Thomas and Mack in Vegas. And Lennox was rightly crowned in a closer fight. Holyfield gave a better account of himself in the rematch, didn't he?
Yeah, much, much better. I think Lennox won by about 2 or 3 points, didn't he, on the cards? And it was by no means as dominant as first time around. Holyfield managed to take the fight and utilise his ability as a good in-fighter, you know, rolling in inside that jab and landing telling blows inside. And it was at least competitive, the second fight. The first fight, I thought Lennox won by a street. I don't know how Ian scored it, but I mean, I seem to remember thinking I had Lennox by about 6 points.
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember, but it was a wide margin. Oh, on everybody's card, really, everybody's card you would have respected anyway. So, yeah, that was crazy. I mean, they were always going to give it to Lennox, weren't they, the second fight, because there was an outrage in America about the whole thing, and they were going to right the wrong. And so, yeah, I think it was a pretty close fight, the second one, and Lennox got it.
So then we have really, I mean, we can move into a different stage of Evander Holyfield's career here from 2000. He has the trilogy with John Ruiz, and then he fights the likes of Haseem Rahman, Chris Bird, James Toney. He has injuries, he has issues, he has a shoulder injury when he's stopped by James Toney. He loses to Larry Donald. So 2004 by now. And this is a point where people are saying, please, Evander, just jack it in. Like, you've made your money, although obviously that the money didn't stay. But just please don't fight on, right? And there was a big sentimental outcry just for him to wrap it up.
Yeah, well, one of his best mates in the boxing media, Evander Holyfield, was Ron Borges, who used to write for the Boston Globe. Really good writer. They were big, big mates. And he told me a great story once about Evander Holyfield. He said that Evander had said to him after a fight pretty early on in his career, he said, "I want you to promise me something, Ron. I want you to promise me that you'll call me and tell me to quit if I ever get to that stage where I'm not the fighter I used to be, and you think like I'm washed up, and you think I'm in danger. Well, after he lost to Tony, who of course was a talented fighter, James Tony that night, Ron rang him and said, do you remember a few years ago, Evander, you told me to give you that call if you thought it was that time? He said, well, I don't want to say it. And he said, but it is that time. You know, I think it's time for you to turn your back on it all now. And he said Evander Holyfield hadn't spoken to him after that for a long, long time. So that was the end of the friendship. He didn't want to hear it. He'd got to that horrible deluded stage that old fighters get to where, you know, they just can't accept that it is the end of the road.
Yeah, it was a sad decline, because obviously to lose to someone like Chris Bird, a useful fighter, but not on Evander's level, James Toney, who was in no condition, but then Evander was safe from further punishment, and then to Larry Donald, these are guys that primetime Holyfield would have negotiated with some ease. So it was sad. Ian, let me ask you this. I mean, we had mentioned Teddy Atlas there. For a lot of those prime years, I think it was Don Turner in Evander's corner.
Yeah.
And not only that, but obviously there was all this stuff, and I think you would have been talking about it. Was it Mackie Shilston who was doing his strength and conditioning? I can't recall who it was. No, it wasn't Mackie. There was someone else.
Tommy Brooks was there in the corner as well with him, I think.
Yeah, yes.
And Don Turner was really good with cuts, wasn't he, too? And I think he got hired because he'd done some good work with Larry Holmes later on. And Holyfield had said he'd found Holmes, even at 42-year-old Larry Holmes, pretty hard to catch cleanly. So, yeah, those two got on. But, you know, we are talking now about that advanced stage of Holyfield's career. And, of course, in the end, he tried to go on past 50, didn't he?
Well, there was this thing. It wasn't Mackie Shilston. It was Tim Hallmark. Do you remember? And Evander was ahead of his time because people were asking about him doing his weight training. And people, you know, the grizzled old vets are saying, what are you lifting weights for? It's only going to make you slow and bulky. Do you remember all that?
I remember vaguely about all of that as well. Yeah, I mean, and there were, of course, you know, the stories that Holyfield had beefed himself up in, let's say, artificial means.
Yeah, so there was all of that discussion, and obviously, you know, his name has become synonymous with Evans Field. If you aren't familiar with Evans Field, then by all means, Google it and check it out. Okay, you ready?
That was Evander Holyfield.
What are you saying about me? That was the lawyer. That was the lawyer's phone. So then, you know, John, we have this descent that continues. He makes a comeback in 2006, and we know that he's lost his fortune. You know, there's a lot of children to pay for, a lot of child maintenance. He's lost this huge mansion that he had in Georgia that made the newspapers around the world. And then the descent continues. Although he does come back and beat the likes of an aged Lou Savarese and a club fighter, Vinnie Madaloni, who was tough but nothing spectacular. He loses to Sultan Abragimov. He loses controversially to the giant, the WBA champion, Valuev, who people thought Evander actually deserved to beat in 2008 in Switzerland. And then he wraps it up with Franz Botha, Sherman the Tank Williams, which is a no contest after Holyfield was cut from a head clash. And then a win over the great Dane, Brian Nielsen, who we've talked about on this podcast before. And John, it was a sad end for Holyfield, wasn't it? There was a, you know, talk about money problems. Talk about, you know, people were thinking his health was in jeopardy in 1996. And here he is still fighting in 2011. It's not great, is it? And there was obviously talk about the long-term health consequences. You know, obviously it's something I've dealt with a lot of in terms of CTE and long-term brain trauma. There's a lot of exposure to punches throughout Evander Holyfield's career, particularly obviously on that downside.
It became very sad to watch. I think with the 2020 vision of hindsight, you'd have certainly liked to have seen him get out of it after John Ruiz's fights, and maybe even before those, before Lennox Lewis, because he kind of became a parody of himself, didn't he? He was
Evander was always blessed with this remarkable physique and the sort of skin whereby he didn't appear to age. You know, you see him now at whatever age he is now, and he's still sort of instantly recognizable as Evander Holyfield. But the further it went, the more he became a shell, and he became almost a prostitute to the world of boxing. Show me the money and I'll get in the ring. It doesn't matter whether or not I'm going to win almost. It's just a question of give me the paycheck. And it just became so sad when you remembered what a terrific fighter he was back in the 90s and through to the Lennox Lewis fights. He had been one of the top heavyweights. You know, there's a good argument that Evander Holyfield may have been an all-time top 10 heavyweight. But in those closing years, it became very, very sad to see. And I was one of those who was wishing from a long way away, for goodness sake, man, do not do this, because you will eventually pay the price.
I always liked him. I'm sure you did, John. I always used to like dealing with him, though. He was great to deal with. I mean, he was the kind of fighter who used to hang around in the press room. You didn't have to go seeking an interview with him. He was around to be interviewed and enjoyed it. And I remember another story once where I was told rather stupidly by my editor, who didn't seem to understand that the way boxing worked when you're on site at the fight. He said, can you get an interview with Holyfield? You know, we need one on the eve of the fight, on the night before the fight. I said, that's not going to happen. So they've had the weigh-in. After that, you don't see the fighters. There's no more set piece media stuff. He said, we'll try. So he was in Caesar's Palace. I think he was staying. And I rang his suite just to go through the motions and said, hi there, I'm Ian Dark from Sky Sports. We were just wondering if we might just get a last minute word with Evander. I know it's a bit of an irregular request. And the guy answering the phone goes, well, he is around here. I said, right. Okay. I said, so happy to do this. He said, well, actually, this is Evander. So I'd rang the suite and he'd answer the phone. I thought it'd be some, you know, lackey or something. And he goes, when do you want to do it? I said, well, anytime that you choose. He goes, we're having tea in half an hour. Come to the sixth floor. He gave me the number. He said, you can have some tea with us. And so I did this interview with Holyfield on the eve of the fight, after the weigh-in, you know, and he thanked me afterwards. He said, thanks for coming round. He said, I've got nothing else to do between now and the fight. He said, this has been quite entertaining. He said, I wish we could do this kind of thing more often. I've never had access to like it. I mean, I love the guy, really.
He was such a class act, Ian. You know, you remember, well, Tyson, for one, was surrounded by a great mob of hoodlums from wherever he managed to pick them up. So when you actually went to try and interview or speak to Mike Tyson, you had to go through this great mob of lunatics to get anywhere near him. Evander, you'd see him just walking through the casino, maybe with Don Turner, maybe with a couple of friends, and that'd be it. He had no entourage. He had that attitude, I'm heavyweight champion of the world. Who's going to frighten me? I don't care. And he was so approachable. And I always remember going back to that first Riddick Bowe fight, when he'd had the most extraordinary war with Bowe, including that astonishing 10th round. Within half an hour, maybe quicker, he was sitting on a stool in front of the world's media, answering any question you wanted to ask. He did a one-on-one interview with me. And I remember just after that, going and doing a football match up in the northwest of England. I think it might have been Oldham or Burnley or somebody. And there was a guy there who was one of the managers at that time, who was being seriously awkward. And I said to him, I've just got back from Las Vegas. And I told him the story about Evander Holyfield and how he was man enough to answer every possible question half an hour after having to go through one of the biggest disappointments of his life. And I said, and you're telling me that you won't do an interview about your team from the second division or third division or whatever it was getting beaten? You won't do an interview? I think that's pathetic.
Yeah, well said, John. Well, I mean, the thing with Evander was he was a blue-collar guy, wasn't he? Blue-collar champion. He was the son of a lumberjack. He used to pump gas into the aeroplanes at Atlanta Airport for $5 an hour. So he knew his roots. He lived in the projects in Atlanta. So there was no ego about him. He was grounded. He was full value in the ring. And, I mean, it was our privilege to cover him all that time as well. I mean, the only awkward thing I used to find with him later on in his career was he'd turn every answer into a religious answer. He went through a phase where whatever you asked him, he said, well, I just know that God's going to be on my side in the corner and, you know, he'll help me through, and whatever problems I've got, God's going to help me. And he kept answering this. This was in front of the rematch with Lennox. And every answer was like that. So eventually I said to him, don't you think God's going to be in Lennox Lewis's corner as well? And he said, that's a really good question. I expect so, but I know he'll be in mine.
Great stuff. I like that. So, I mean, in terms of Evander as a person, I know Evander. I can't claim that he knows me, but we've spoken a lot over the years. And I think the last time we talked, he sent me a Bible verse or a parable or a phrase from the Bible every day for years. And that stopped a few months ago, but he was texting me every day. And then I realized that he clearly, I don't know if he sent it to every number in his phone book, or just a few people maybe thought I was a lost soul or a lost cause, maybe. I don't know if it went to everybody, but I certainly read that some other people were getting the same thing every day from Evander.
I think he thought you needed it, Chris.
Yeah, quite possibly. So before we leave our listeners, we did ask on Twitter for some questions for you guys. And the response has been really good. There's no way we'll get to them all. But Scott Hindle says, for Ian and John, who do you fancy? Holyfield v. Usyk, best two cruiserweights ever. Ian.
Ooh, I don't know. I never like these cross-generational fights because it's hard to imagine. But I don't know. I just think that iron will of Holyfield's might just get him through against all that technical skill of Usyk. So maybe a bit controversially, I'll say that Holyfield nicks it on points.
I'd go with Holyfield as well. And the reason being that for all the outstanding technical ability of Usyk, I think that Holyfield was the harder hitter, the stronger man, possibly took a shot better in his prime. And I think Holyfield was exceptional. It would have been interesting, but I think Holyfield might just have been a bit too hard and a bit too tough.
Williams wasn't scoring it, we're fine.
It's worth weighing up, actually, that fight, whether it was at cruiserweight or if they were to have it at heavyweight, because it might be two different fights. But anyway, Mike Hills says, I loved Holyfield, but the second Tyson fight, I can see why Mike exploded. Evander headbutting Tyson was an error on Mills Lane's refereeing. I feel that Mike was up for the fight. What are your opinions? Ian, just you on this one.
No, I don't agree completely with that. I disagree with almost everything he's just said, really, about that. I don't think Tyson was out for the fight. I do think he was looking for a way out. And yes, Holyfield was a bit free with his head at times, but nothing can justify biting the guy's ear off.
Well, I mean, you're not from the same streets as Mike Hills then. Fair play to Mike for the question. Thank you. Dean Burks, one for John. When Evander was a cruiserweight, did you think he would move up and have the success he had at heavyweight? Did you envisage it?
Probably not. Probably didn't think that he'd go up and won. He was absolutely no seed as a professional fighter, as a big professional fighter. He really had no option other than to go up to heavyweight. And having done so, of course, we know what a massive success he made of it and an absolute fortune that he won.
So, Ian, you've voted yourself out of this next question, which comes from Anish, the boxing fan man, because it's a cross-generation one, but it's an interesting one. I like it. So, John, this is for you again. Evander was known as a small heavyweight 25 years ago, but was competitive against the very best. How would he fare against the huge heavyweights of this generation, i.e. Fury, Wilder and Joshua? I mean, Wilder, technically, he's not a huge heavyweight in terms of weight, but size-wise, obviously 6'7". So how do you think Evander mixes in with the current crop?
Well, I think he'd do okay. You know, I mean, you can ask the same question about Mike Tyson. You know, Tyson is about 5'10". I know he claims to be 6 foot, but there's no way on earth that Mike Tyson is 6 feet tall. And Evander Holyfield was 3 or 4 inches taller than him. I think most people would say that Mike could have given a good account of himself against anybody on his day for a couple of years. And I think likewise, Evander Holyfield, I think as a heavyweight, I think he'd have done just fine.
So there's a couple more questions, guys. There's a few about steroids and stuff, which, you know, we mentioned the Evansfield thing earlier on, so people can make their own conclusions, not for us to throw allegations at people. But I do have a question here for you, Ian, that's not related to that. And it's an interesting the way it's written. So it's from Goal Short. Did Evander believe that the first fight with Lennox wasn't a draw and that Lennox won? So in Evander's mind, do you think heart of hearts, he thought he won, or do you think he thought Lennox deserved it?
Well, I can't read his mind, but I do understand the question. And I think he knows enough about boxing and had fought long enough to know he didn't win that fight. He will have known that he hadn't done enough. And I think if you look at his face as the scores are being read out, and I had a little look back on this just before we did this podcast, you can kind of see there is just a hint of surprise, really, when they say it's a split decision. So I think he knew that Lennox had won the fight. But, you know, I think as a professional fighter, you probably in your mind reorganize that and you say, well, you get a lot of bad breaks in this business. I've got a good one and we move on. So that's okay. Probably how he looked at it.
I like that. So the same question now to both of you. We'll wrap up with this one. And I like this from Gary Mullen. Because you guys, I'm sure, John, you would have certainly written about this, and Ian, you would have had to discuss it at some point. It says, I'd like to know about the sparring session with Tyson when they were both young. Allegedly, it was stopped pretty quickly as Tyson wasn't able to handle him. Now, Gary's asked for a definitive truth or myth, but that's something that was in the news. You know, people were talking about it, weren't they? Ian, I'll start with you, and then we'll wrap up with John. Ian, people did talk about this rivalry and how Evander apparently never took a backward step with Tyson when they were kids. And you know, that carried over to adulthood.
Well, there are all kinds of myths, aren't there, and rumours about things that are supposed to have happened in the gym with what size gloves, we don't know, often used for PR purposes. But I'm prepared to believe that story, really, that Holyfield, even then, might have worked out that Tyson, if you got him on the back foot, he wasn't going to be nearly as effective. So I don't know. I don't know definitively, but I'm prepared to believe, you know, from what we saw later, that story is probably true.
John?
There's only two people who properly know the truth of that one, isn't it? It's Evander and Mike. They're the only ones who really know what happened. But I know what I thought from an early stage is that Holyfield, and then having seen the fight when it took place, that Holyfield had Mike Tyson's number. I think quite possibly he always would have had Mike Tyson's number. And the big reason was that for whatever reason, maybe going back to those days when they shared a ring as kids, he was simply not afraid.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of his quotes, and I've got written down here on a commentary card, is, in my mind, I was never an underdog.
Yeah. Yeah. And in his mind, he probably never lost to Lennox Lewis in the first fight. But still, guys, this has been a lot of fun looking back over the career of Evander Holyfield. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it's been really good. You've obviously covered him a lot through the highs and the lows. Obviously, the both Mora fights, the Tyson fights, the Bo trilogy, the Fan Man, a few at the end, a few at the start, and obviously at the Olympics and plenty of behind-the-scenes stuff, so some really good stuff. Before I leave our listeners and before I leave you guys, I just want to say thanks for checking out Ringside Rewind. If you can, give us a rate and review online and spread the word. Word of mouth is hugely helpful for us as we try to build our audience base. Gents, thank you so much for your time about the great Evander Holyfield. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys. Great, bye-bye.
Great talk about the real deal.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.